Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and today is a tech update to start the show. We're answering your technology questions, and we'll be taking a look at the security of our personal information as well with our guest, Beth D'Angelo, Senior IT Specialist in UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. Call in with your thoughts about maybe how safe your data might be. We'll take your general tech questions as well. So if you're having problems with your phone or your computer, I hope you'll join in with your questions. Number to call, 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Beth D'Angelo, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Good morning, Larry. How are you?
I'm a little cough. You may catch a cough once in a while. I'm finally getting over whatever it was I had, but feeling a whole lot better. But I've been watching the news, of course, within the last couple of weeks. The Department of Government Efficiency, I think it's called DOGE, has received some access to the computer systems of, the U.S. Treasury, the Medicare and Medicaid services, and the Veterans Administration. What are the main concerns that have been raised there?
Well, I think a couple of the main concerns that I've heard are the type of access that folks are being given to systems that do contain really sensitive personal information about millions and millions of Americans. Also, you know, what's being done with that information once it's accessed. So those are really kind of the two different paths folks are talking in right now.
Yeah, the Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said the DOGE team has read-only access to the payment system of the fiscal service. What does that mean?
So there's different types of access that you can give to systems for folks like me, administrators of those systems, to be able to either make changes or to look into databases or documents that are stored within those systems. So something like read-only access would allow you to see files and to maybe search and seek out information that's stored within databases, but not actually make changes to the system. However, there's some controversy as to whether or not it's read-only access that's been given, or if some of the folks who have come in recently now actually have administrative privileges to those systems, which is a whole different level of security.
Yeah. In general, how worried should we be about the security of the personal information the government holds?
Well, I would be concerned. The focus right now is on access to financial systems, so systems that disperse payments to everywhere, you know, down to the individual receiving Social Security or Medicare payments, any number of, government contract organizations. There's a lot of banking information that's included in those systems that could potentially be compromised if cybersecurity protocols aren't followed to ensure that data is kept safe.
Yeah. Bonnie and Wanakee emailed wondering maybe, because things are up in the air a little bit, should we just put a credit freeze on our accounts as a precaution?
Yeah, that's one option. So folks who are concerned about financial data potentially being leaked or their personal identifying information potentially being part of some sort of a data breach, you can freeze your credit. So what that does is basically it puts a hold on any new credit inquests. So anybody trying to gain information from one of the major credit bureaus or apply for credit, it will freeze that request and send an alert to you to let you know that that's happening. So folks can have a little bit of assurance knowing that their data isn't being used to steal their identity or to for fraudulent financial reasons.
And that doesn't mean you can't use your credit cards or things of that nature.
No. Basically, it's freezing your credit so that no new accounts can be created under your credit history without express permission from you. So kind of creates a barrier to folks who might be worried about their data being stolen and used, you know, against their will.
Kay emailed, they were recently notified by a free tracking service that's available on their credit cards that their personal information, including social security number, has been found on the dark web. Kay's frozen her credit, and one of the credit services also offers a service to remove your personal information from the web for you for a monthly fee. Are these services reliable? Will they help, or is this something she could do herself?
So removing data from the internet is a really difficult and arduous task. It really depends on how far and wide data has been spread. There are companies that do now offer a service of trying to scrub that data from the internet, but I'm very skeptical about their efficacy at doing that. I think a really important step to take if you have been notified of some sort of a data breach that your data was a part of is to go through and change passwords on any of the financial or health or any kind of account that contains your personal information that could be linked back to health or financial data for you. So if you have a notification like that, first thing I would do is go and change all your passwords.
Chandler in Madison is concerned about having personal information being made public to some people. What's the level, Chandler wondering, what's the level of concern we should have at this point? Is there any other action you could recommend as precautionary measures against those with who may be inexperienced and have diverse interests other than your own?
Yeah, there's a lot of different ways that you can protect your data, you know, locally, steps that you can take. First and foremost would be to use strong passwords. So anytime you are creating a password for an account, create unique, strong passwords for all of your online accounts. You can use a password manager for storing those on your devices. I highly recommend using one of those. But anything that is a larger alphanumeric with special characters, some capitals, some lowercase, using non-standard words or not names or anything linked to you that people could figure out, like part of your name or part of your birth date. So creating strong passwords is the first barrier. Using two-factor authentication. So any online services that offer two-factor authentication as an option, I would go ahead and enable those and have that two-factor linked back to your device or another method of authenticating, like through your email. Using a VPN service is also a great way to ensure your protection, especially if you're using any kind of public Wi-Fi. I would use a VPN on the device that I had on public Wi-Fi. Like we talked about earlier, freezing your credit is an option. Or just putting financial credit monitoring on your accounts to alert you to any suspicious activity is also an option if you don't want to go as far as freezing your credit.
And if you do freeze your credit, it doesn't take a lot of time, I don't think, to unfreeze it, does it? Yeah, let's say you suddenly you wanted to get your car broke down, you need a new car and you need credit or something.
Right. It really depends on the service you go through for freezing your credit. I don't think that it's too arduous to unfreeze it, but there are certain protections that they put in place to ensure that you are who you say you are when you are actually going through that process. So really, it's setting up the security ahead of time, so it's easy in the long run to make changes to it in the future.
Yeah. The federal government computer code, it's written in programming language that isn't necessarily compatible with modern software. From an IT perspective, you're an IT person, how vulnerable are these government computer systems?
Yeah, that's one of the tricky things when you talk about like large government, especially financial database systems. A lot of those were initially built on larger mainframe computer systems using something like COBOL for their programming language, and many state and federal agencies are still dependent on mainframe systems to control those kind of payment level services. And a much older code, not, you know, as you would say, compatible with a lot of modern technologies. Maintaining those systems is really what's tricky. It's finding folks that are still well enough versed in the older programming languages to keep systems like that online. And it's becoming increasingly difficult to find those people and also to find parts and service needed for the older machines that are housing those types of systems.
So there needs to be, there may need to be an upgrading of those systems, but I assume that is a very complex process.
Yeah, and I know that's been underway for decades in various government agencies, moving away from mainframe platforms into more modern platforms for financial services. But they are like a giant Gordian knot to undo and build new. So I don't imagine that it's easy or simple.
Joe in Jefferson has a question. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I think I speak for a lot of people that might even be afraid to call in right now about this topic. I think even more than personal data, what about what is Elon Musk and his team of power nerds doing? We have no way to know what they're doing, and how will we know when they're done what they did? Can they be installing backdoor software? I've heard that, you know, other stuff that Elon himself can enrich himself by maybe, you know, tweaking the way things are being paid, and at least in the Treasury. So I think there's a lot. It's all over the internet, but I know this is not a political show normally, but this is a huge topic, and I just wanted to voice that. Maybe your professional guests can comment on how they can maybe go in after the smoke clears here, if possible, and see what maybe was put on. And I heard that there might be a way that you would never know what they even did, that they're so sneaky. So, yeah, that's it.
Yeah, without getting too deep into the political weeds, there are ways to trace back previous activity on any system that you would imagine our government uses, especially for financial services. So anytime a change is made to a system like that, it's logged. Logs are generally, for systems like this, managed in multiple different locations. So if they're scrubbed from the system itself, they may be sent off to an external system for managing those log files, and future audits can go back within those logs to see what changes were made, who they were made by, when they were made, and what the impact of those changes was. So what I'm hoping is that when the dust does settle on kind of what's up in the air right now, that there are folks who are able to kind of track back what has happened and piece together what needs to be reversed or altered or amended to make sure that systems function as they're supposed to.
Yeah. Last month, the Chinese artificial intelligence startup DeepSeek, I believe it's called, seriously challenged the kind of dominance of American tech companies. Can you explain what it is and how it's challenged us?
Yeah, DeepSeek is a newer AI platform that has recently become popular, and they unfortunately have some deep ties back to the Chinese government that were uncovered by some other AI intelligence pulling apart their code and determining that they're sending a whole lot of data to a company that is closely affiliated with the Chinese government. A little scary to take a look at what it actually collects and can send. So there is talk of a potential ban on that service on devices in the U.S., similar to what was happening with TikTok recently.
Yeah, so, and I imagine the arrival of DeepSeek, it's affected the value of companies like OpenAI and NVIDIA.
Yeah, they certainly have come in having spent quite a bit less on the overall development of the product. So I think they're, undercutting the established organizations that have put out things like OpenAI and other services. And I think the main concern right now is the amount of data that can be captured by this service and where that data is going.
And what does it mean, an open model? When you talk about open model, what does that actually mean?
So when you talk about open source, it means that the code for a product is not owned by like a for-profit entity. It is contributed to and open to view by the public. So the actual underlying code for the service is not proprietary and not a guarded secret by the organization that owns it. It's actually open to the public to see, to contribute to, and to use for other purposes.
Oh. Beth D'Angelo, our guest today, senior IT specialist of UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. Questions for her? I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at technology issues today with Beth D'Angelo, senior IT specialist at UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. Great to have her with us. Coming up at 12:30 today, we'll talk about the health benefits and accuracy of personal fitness trackers. But right now, taking a look at your technology and answering your questions. I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. Got an email from Bill to say their phone was hacked and their location and personal data were used on a variety of apps and website. Bill said they now use Aura to identify and request removal of Bill's information from those sites. Verizon issued them a new SIM card and reset their phone. Bill wants to know, how could someone get access to another person's phone and location tracking data over a SIM card without physically accessing the phone?
Wow, that is something I haven't heard of before. I would imagine that you would have to be on a shared network with a device in order to get access to the SIM card. I don't know that I've heard of a SIM card itself being hacked via cell service, so that is really concerning. At the break, I was doing a little bit more looking at these data removal services from the internet. And, I think that the general consensus out there is that they're not completely, 100% accurate in catching everything. But with some of the AI technology that's out there now, it's getting easier for services to find your data that may have been compromised and scrub it from the internet. So that may be a service that you'd want to look into further.
Let's take a call from Steve in Sun Prairie. Steve, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, it's my understanding in every news media report that I've seen in relation to Doge is the only access that Elon Musk's team has is read-only access, which allows them to go into databases, maybe retrieve emails, read those emails. There's no write-back. Has there been any evidence at all that there's any write-back queries that are being done, or is it really only read-only and we should really stop the fear-mongering?
Yeah, I haven't seen actual evidence yet that anyone has been given administrative privileges to these systems. There is some talk in the media that that is a possibility. I think that's something that would need to be proven through investigating the systems themselves and taking a look at permissions. And, I would certainly want to have some evidence that it was something other than read-only access. And hopefully that read-only access doesn't allow any data to be exfiltrated from those systems.
Yeah. Thanks for that question. Appreciate it. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. I see that Microsoft and OpenAI are looking into whether the makers of DeepSeek improperly obtained ChatGPT data, you know, those are famously trained on other people's data without permission. Is this a, maybe the case of the pot calling the kettle black?
Yeah, it's interesting how the AI companies are kind of justifying training their models on, you know, what's out in the commons. And so they're using data that exists out there in the public, but then, you know, producing new content that's being used for that, you know, how do they put protections around new content to ensure that, you know, folks are following, you know, any copyright control laws or any of those regulations related to intellectual property.
During these monthly tech updates, we often get calls from people having questions or technical difficulties with their home printers and scanners. Or you might hear complaints about expensive replacement ink cartridges, you know, these printers require. How necessary is it to have a printer or a scanner in your home these days?
Yeah, I think it's getting less and less necessary to have one around. You know, with especially with, you know, digital barcode technology and being able to, you know, scan things with your phone and, you know, the most of our documents are now stored online. It's becoming less of a necessity to have an actual physical printer in your house. So there are a lot of different ways that you can obtain documents in physical form if you need to.
Yeah, I guess, you know, we may be printing things we don't need paper copies of anymore, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, folks, I think, have trouble letting go of a physical copy of certain things. And I understand wanting to be able to print, especially documents that have sensitive information on them. You want to use a personal printer for that, something you have control over that's either in your home or in your office. But for most documents, there are other options than having to have a printer sitting at home. For instance, most public libraries offer free or really low-cost printing services, even without a library card. So if you want to download and print something, you can do that right at your local library.
Yeah. What about scanners? I mean, do we really need scanners anymore?
Honestly, no. There are now lots of capture programs for your smartphone that allow you to scan a document directly with your smartphone camera. So you really don't need a separate device anymore.
Yeah. Well, if you've
unless you're doing like high resolution scanning, or you know, you want to do some sort of specialized photo work, there really isn't a need for the desktop flatbed scanners anymore.
How do you get? I mean, how do you dispose of a printer? I mean, I imagine you have to go through normal. Whatever the government, your local city government or town government has disposal sites to place it, I would guess.
Yeah, there most local city governments have e-waste recycling centers. There are also like multiple retailers that have e-waste recycling programs. So if you go to any of the big box stores like Best Buy or Staples, you can recycle your electronics there. If it's still in working condition, you can donate it to a local organization. A school, a library, a community center, maybe a good option for that. But if it's no longer in working condition, obviously you want to go through a proper environmental recycling facility for it.
Barnaby in Madison, we'll give you a chance to join in. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hey, Larry, thanks for taking my call. I guess I'm really upset about what's going on with Doge and their apparently really their ease of getting into our secure system. And I'm curious, since we have someone from UW here, what would you do if a bunch of Doge brown shirt goons walked into your office and demanded copies of all of your hard drives? And I think it's interesting that everyone's conversation seems to be about whether it's read or write. Yeah, it's true. We don't want to give them write because then they can alter the code. But read is just as heinous. That's the largest data breach in human history. They have just sucked up and vacuumed everything in those systems. And that is dangerous. By any measure, that's dangerous.
Well, Beth, what do you think?
Well, I would hope nobody would storm into my office and demand hard drives, but fortunately, that would probably happen well above my pay grade. You know, we do have some really robust cybersecurity protections in place at the university that, you know, don't allow for this type of access to be easily given away to someone. I am hoping that our federal government has similar controls in place that aren't allowing, you know, any sort of nefarious activity to take place. I don't have a ton of confidence in that right now, but unfortunately, we don't know a lot that's certain with this type of situation that's unfolding.
Yeah. Eileen in Janesville, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Eileen.
Hi. I have two questions. The first one, I think, is related to the previous caller. What is preventing somebody who has a computer who can go in and find my data, even if it's read-only? Can they take a photograph of that and then go to the screen and make another photograph? I know it's a lot of bother, but somebody who wants to get it could do it that way. I don't have a computer, so I wonder how I can save my information that's the computers.
Beth, so what
looking
are you...
looking to save information.
So Eileen is asking first, could they with a read only? Could you read copy and then just photocopy it, or make a picture of the information? And then use that information. And her second part was, she doesn't have a computer, but of course there's a lot of personal information out there, you know, relating whatever it might be, Social Security or something else. How do you protect that information if you don't have a computer?
Yeah, I think a good way to protect that information would be to subscribe to a credit monitoring service that would essentially protect that information from being used to hurt you financially. Something that could either alert you over the phone that a potential, breach to your personal information has happened, or through some other method. But if you don't have a computer, there's not a lot of ways that, you know, I guess you could use a smartphone to access some of those services as well. The read-only access to, you know, government financial systems is still concerning. Even without administrative privileges to those systems, there are a number of different ways that information could leak, and whether it's read-only or read-write or admin access, I think without proper personnel procedures in place to manage the people that are accessing those systems, that's really what we should be more concerned with, because we can only protect so much with technology. We also have to take an appropriate way of accessing those things via, controls on personnel and the people who are accessing it.
Beth D'Angelo, our guest, and you can join in, too. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. If you have a question or comment, that we'd love to hear from you. Willem in Colfax, your turn. Hi, Willem.
Hi. One thing I would like to say is that there are public libraries, and they have access to the Internet, so you don't even have to own this stuff. It's still, you know, libraries are the great equalizer. But I saw yesterday a man whose name I can't remember. He was appointed by Mr. Trump in his first term as head of cybersecurity, and he was commenting on how dangerous he thought what the administration was doing. Just laying off these experienced people. It takes years to train and to know what they're doing, and then just to cut them seems irresponsible. Like, if your house needs remodeling, you don't burn it down. You know, you fix the house. You fix what needs to be fixed, but you don't ruin the whole thing. And it's being done by an unelected official in this DOGE, which I don't even think is constitutional because it hasn't been vetted by the Senate in their advising consent. That's what it says in the U.S. Constitution. He can't just, by edict, create whole people like, you know, richest man in the world or something. We didn't elect that.
Beth, care to comment?
I think the complex nature of these financial systems and the folks who have built and managed those systems for many decades being pushed out of the way in favor of, you know, somebody who has little to no experience with the system that they are now having access to, whether it's read-only or administrative access, really undermines a lot of the hard work that's gone into building the security systems around those financial systems over those years. There are, you know, they're extremely complex, and to come in from the outside with little to no knowledge of how those systems work or the impact of changes to those systems is very dangerous. The folks who manage them have likely been doing so for many years and have a lot of experience with navigating the complexities of those systems and services. And to put someone in place who is unfamiliar with that and to come in and start making very sweeping changes without using standard change management practices and standard cybersecurity practices is what is really concerning to me.
Yeah. Beth D'Angelo, our guest, again, join in. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Tim in Hayward wonders if you can set up a server in your home to better protect personal information, and can it be done, you know, for cheap? Let's put it cheaply, or less expensively than what you might think.
Yeah, I mean, it all depends on what you're trying to protect. If it's documents that you don't want to store in a cloud service, that you want to store locally and I guess not make them accessible outside of your home, you can store them on a computer that is not internet connected using a device like a external hard drive to go between that computer and one that is connected to the internet. Obviously with some protection software on both of those. But setting up your own home server to protect your digital information really isn't going to do much for you because most of your digital information is being stored by the services that you signed up for subscriptions with or made accounts with that are cloud-based services where that data is not under your control. What I would really be more concerned with is using something like a VPN service to protect your connection to your data so that is what is not hijacked in order to steal your information or to, potentially infiltrate your home network or devices.
Tom sent an email. If Windows 10, this is back to this, your personal technology, if Windows 10 will still be functional and supported if you don't have Windows 11?
Yeah, 10 has an end-of-life date of October the 14th of this year, which means there will no longer be updates provided for Windows 10 for your devices. So say you have a laptop at home as Windows 10 on it, and you're used to getting Microsoft updates on a weekly or a monthly basis. You'll no longer get those security updates, and eventually it'll be much harder to install software on that machine because newer software that comes out won't be compatible with that version of Windows, so it'll become more and more difficult to use that machine, as it goes beyond the October 14th date.
And John was wondering about slow internet. What causes slow internet speeds?
Slow internet speeds. The first thing I would look at is, you know, we start with the device. Is my device too far away from my Wi-Fi router? Am I not getting enough bars of service? Is there anything in between my Wi-Fi router and my device that may be causing interference that could be weakening the signal? If it's not my Wi-Fi router that's causing it, what's the speed of the actual signal coming in? So using a speed monitoring app, you can download like I can't remember the name of the one that I use. That actually, it's I think Speed Test is the name of it, and it tells you what speed your internet is running on. You can put that on your cell phone and switch between your cellular internet and your Wi-Fi internet, and you can see what the difference in speed is to find out where the bottleneck might be there. Or it could just be that your internet service provider is having some sort of outage that is deprecating the service, making it not as efficient.
Beth D'Angelo, excuse me. Boy, oh boy, I'm sorry. Beth is a senior IT specialist at UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Tomorrow at this time, we'll talk about some common gastrointestinal issues and colonoscopies. Then we'll learn about how to maintain your eyesight. A couple of doctors on the show to talk about that. Right now, we're taking your questions on technology and personal security with your devices with our guest, Beth D'Angelo, senior IT specialist at UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Somebody else is wondering, you've mentioned VPN or what's it called, virtual personal network. How hard is it or how difficult is it to set up a VPN?
It's actually pretty simple. There are multiple vendors out there that you can purchase VPN services through. It's essentially you download an app onto your device, whether it's your phone that you want to use a VPN on or a laptop or a tablet. You sign up for the service. It walks you through like a setup wizard, essentially specific to how you're going to use it, and then gives you the option to turn on and turn off the VPN and tells you where that happens within the app, and you're set. So really not a huge deal to set one up.
Is it much expense involved?
There are, kind of a variety of prices, usually in the $2 to $10 or $15 a month, depending on how long you buy it for. If you purchase a year at a time, you can get it for about $3.50 a month, which is a pretty decent plan for, protecting all of your devices at once.
Yeah, that's not bad. Kay and Madison emailed questions about password managers. They recently switched to DuckDuckGo web browser. Been working great. Kay wants to know if there's a DuckDuckGo that they can use on their phone. And would the password manager then access the passwords Kay is currently only using on her computer?
Yeah, so if you set up a password manager service, you can essentially synchronize your passwords that are on your computer to a service in the cloud, and then you download an app on your phone that synchronizes those passwords down to your phone. So you can use the same manager service to manage your password across multiple devices.
Okay, so it can pretty easily be done. Lance emailed to say they need a big hard drive, 4 terabytes to back up photos and graphics work. And Lance wants a powered, sturdy drive. They're not needing portability, so it's something I'm probably out of the home. What should Lance look for?
They're looking for an external hard drive that doesn't necessarily need to be portable, but has a whole lot of storage on it. There are a whole bunch of options out there. Western Digital is always a really good option for hard drives. They've got some 5 terabyte hard drives that are under $100. Most of the external hard drives are going to be portable. Some are going to be larger than others, but because it's an external hard drive, they're just manufactured that way to be portable. But yeah, they've gotten really inexpensive, so you can get a whole lot of storage space for not much money.
Yeah. Barry is traveling in Europe this summer. Do you have any suggestions on how he should get phone service? Should he get a phone there, or should he just add to his plan? What's the best way?
Depending on how long you're going to be there for, it may be worthwhile just to add on international service to your phone plan for the time that you're going to be traveling. You can pay for like a month at a time and add on international service. That'll give you a certain number of minutes for talk, amount of time for amount of text messages that you can send, and it'll give you a specific amount of data that you can use per day. If you are going to be there for a longer period of time, it might be better to purchase a SIM card locally when you arrive. You can buy a SIM card to put in your phone to activate a local service, and then just pay for that, you know, upfront as needed. Couple different ways you can do it. You don't need to buy a whole new phone, though.
Charles in Oshkosh has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Charles.
Hi. As far as usernames and passwords, what do you recommend? And hopefully that's nothing that Elon Musk can look at on and take a picture of or screenshot.
As far as I know, you know, Elon Musk doesn't own any password manager organizations yet, but there are a whole bunch of different services out there for password managers. 1Password is a pretty popular one that I actually use, 1Password. There's also one called NordPass, which is something you can bundle with, I believe, the NordVPN service. That's a password manager, so a couple of options for that. Those are, you know, there's also, if you go out to PC Magazine, PCMag.com, they've got some great recommendations. If you search for best password managers, they go down through the whole list of them and list out the prices and the various comparison details of each.
Charles, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Mary emailed to say they have a perfectly good laptop, not too old. However, it won't run Windows 11. Because some hardware part is incompatible with it, and Mary's considering switching to an alternate operating system like Linux and would like to know pros and cons. The software Mary uses are Word and Excel. Most other usage is via internet browsers. What other operating system should Mary consider besides Linux?
Yeah, there isn't a lot out there if you're talking about what we call an x86 platform or what would normally house a Windows operating system. So there's Ubuntu, which is a version of Linux that's pretty popular out there and pretty user-friendly. That's one that I would definitely recommend. The other option is potentially the Chrome OS, the OS that's used for Chromebooks. Maybe something that you can install on your laptop as an operating system if you want to make it kind of an easier setup and something that's pretty simple and that will be compatible with a lot of simpler, older technologies.
Yeah. John wonders, his computer keeps disconnecting from Wi-Fi. And, of course, that screws up a lot of activities you need to be performing online. Why would a computer disconnect or, you know, constantly disconnect from Wi-Fi?
Generally, that's caused by like a weak signal or some sort of interference between your router and the device that you're on. What I would do is, first and foremost, it's just to restart the router. That's going to be 90% of the time. It's going to fix issues that you're having with your internet connection dropping. Rebooting the router, if you have a separate Wi-Fi access point that's not part of your router, you'll want to reboot that after your router comes back up. So once you've got full power restored to the router, then unplug and plug back in your Wi-Fi access point. Once those are back up, test your service, see if it's working any better. If you're still getting a lot of dropped connections, it may be a problem with your actual internet service provider, the service coming to your house. So then I would reach out to your internet service provider and have them run some tests on your connection to make sure you're getting a proper signal.
Yeah, that makes good sense. What's the best system for checking on malware?
Yeah, I use something called Malwarebytes, which it's something you can download in demo for free, so you don't have to pay for it. It'll do a scan of your system, and it'll let you know if there's anything that it finds that could be concerning. Also, you can pay for the service to get an updated version with the kind of latest and greatest detection behind it if you want to pay for the Malwarebytes service. But it's a good place to start in looking for that type of issue.
Yeah. Beth DeAngelo, our guest, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email address talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. What do you do with a frozen or a stuck computer? I mean, how do you get out of that mess?
Usually you reboot it. So, like if you're on a computer and if the whole screen's frozen, everything's frozen up, press and hold the power button down for about 10 seconds. That will shut it off and turn it back on usually. If it's like a printer or something that's frozen and the power button isn't cycling the power, you can unplug it and then plug it back in to recycle the power on that. But Larry, I got to tell you, 9 times out of 10, rebooting something fixes it. It's really the first stop. Especially when you've got a frozen machine. If it's not coming unfrozen, just reboot it.
Yeah, I must have gone at least 10 would be a charitable number to the IT person here. And,
yep.
And the first thing they do is restart it. It took about 10 times for me to decide that, oh, wait a minute, maybe I should just restart it myself.
Well, we all have a joke, you know, all of us IT folks amongst each other have a joke, you know, whenever somebody has a problem that they haven't been able to figure out, we say, well, did you try turning it off and turning it back on? So, but it's, you know, the joke is true. Try turning it off and turning it back on.
Oh, man. I tell you, the issue that comes up pretty often is with batteries, battery drain issues. My watch, for example, you know, I couldn't dare leave that on overnight because it'd be dead in the morning.
Yeah, it's for sure. A lot of devices now, you know, you're seeing that the battery life on them, you know, it starts off great when you first get it. And then as you use the device, maybe a year or a year and a half, 2 years, it doesn't seem to hold a charge like it used to. And there's some planned obsolescence that's built into the batteries on our devices so that we don't hold on to our devices for longer than a lot of companies want us to. So there are some things you can do to prolong the life of the battery in your devices. One of those is to not let that battery run all the way down and then charge it back up. So to keep it, you know, around 80% charged if possible. Also, you don't want to overcharge your devices. So if you plug it in overnight and it charges to 100% in a couple of hours and then stays plugged in, some of the older devices, that'll cause dead spots in the battery, but in newer devices, they have settings that you can go in and tell it optimal charging times and kind of optimize it so that it stops charging and doesn't create dead spots in your battery. But like I said, unfortunately, you know, you're always going to start off with your maximum battery power, and as you use that device, it is going to lose capacity over time.
Yeah, unfortunately. Beth DeAngelo, our guest, she'll be with us right up till 12:30 today. Paul and Madison and other callers, you hang on, and we'll be back right after this look at the news. Stay with us. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at technology today with Beth DeAngelo, Senior IT Specialist at UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. Great to have her along. And let's take a call from Paul. Paul in Madison, thank you for waiting. What's on your mind?
You bet. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, actually, I have a two-parter. One is a follow-up to the question that a caller had about the international cell service, specifically in Europe. What my wife and I found after a couple of trips to Spain and Portugal was that purchasing an international plan may not be sufficient. What we found was you actually needed to have the cell provider unblock the SIM card, because without them doing that, it was the international plan wouldn't function. So what we had to do was make sure that we had paid off our phones, and then that cell provider would unlock the SIM card for us. And that still didn't work. So what we ended up doing then, we paid off our phones, got the and then added an additional eSIM to our phone, and that worked beautifully. Be careful working with your cell phone provider, that both the SIM card and the eSIM card thing. That's just some additional information there. But my question is about an old computer, an old Dell laptop that I have that weighs a brick, and it's from I haven't logged on it since like 2005. I want to bring it to an e-waste recycling place, a municipal site. Are they just going to destroy it? How do I make sure that it's wiped or something of that nature before I just drop it off at that municipal recycling center?
Yeah, so that is a concern. If you're taking something in with a hard drive on it, I would actually take the hard drive out of the machine before I take it to the recycling center, unless that recycling center has what's called a degausser, or it's really a high-powered magnet that they would run the machine through that would wipe all your data physically, essentially, from the machine. So unless that's something that is advertised as part of the e-waste recycling facility, I would remove the hard drive from the machine before you recycle it and keep that, or you can, take it to a place that does have a degausser to erase it yourself.
Yeah.
And as for the eSIM, that's a good tip. It really does depend on your provider, whether or not an international plan will function internationally, and whether or not they will unlock your phone to work on the GSM network in Europe. So that is a good tip on making sure your phone's paid off and having an eSIM, depending on your carrier. So you obviously want to check with your carrier to see what the requirements are to actually use your phone for data while you're traveling.
Paul, thanks a lot for calling. As you were talking about degausser, I was thinking back to my days of earlier days as a broadcaster, where we had magnetic recording tape, and every studio had a degausser that it was a big old magnet that would kind of re-scramble those iron oxide particles and clean the tape. So,
yep, that's exactly what they do.
It was pretty cool to think back to that. Rod and Weyerhaeuser, your turn. Hi, Rod.
Hey, you. Hello, Larry. Thank you for taking my call. Yeah, I just was a quick one. Wondered about these cell phones. My neighbor told me when you plug them into the, in your vehicle, the 12-volt DC charger, if that's true, it definitely charges your phone way faster. But he said that they say you really shouldn't do it because it ain't good for the battery. The battery won't last. You should charge it slowly in your house. I had another comment too.
Yeah, is that the case?
Yeah. Charging your phone off of the battery in your car can overload the battery with a higher voltage than it's supposed to take. It is possible to damage the battery by using the actual car charger more often than you're using your home charger. It is charging at a different voltage. There's also the issue of your cell phone charger draining too much power from your car's electrical system and doing the opposite. So it can also dim your lights or cause slow starting or even electrical failures. So there are some downsides to using your car's power for charging your phone or your devices.
Oh, there you go, Rod.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that information. Yeah. I usually try to charge it in the house, but it's a noticeable difference.
It is indeed. I've got a friend that just plugs his in automatically every time he gets in the car, and I don't think that's a good idea myself.
Some older cars too, they have USB ports in them for charging, but they're a much lower output than the actual phone needs. So sometimes it can screw up charging a little bit there too.
Yeah. Thanks, Rod. Appreciate the call. You can join in, too. The number's 800-642-1234 or email to talk at WPR.org. Chandler in Madison. We'll go to you next. Hi, Chandler.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I'm just calling regarding laptop screen extender monitors. I'm curious about getting one of these primarily for work when traveling, and just wondering if there's any security to be concerned about or readability of data that these might have.
Hmm. What do you think, Beth?
Sorry about that. I was on mute. So laptop screen extenders, I don't think there's any like security issues that you need to worry about with those. I think it's really just a physical output to an additional monitor that connects to your machine. I don't think there is any like wireless data that transmits as far as I can tell. So, you know, if you're looking for something with a larger screen so you can extend your laptop display, as long as it's a physical connection to your device, then I wouldn't be too worried about any security concerns for it.
Oh, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. An email about facial recognition technology. Now some cell phones can be unlocked with the owner's face. What do you think of facial recognition from a personal security standpoint?
Well, I think that it's really hard to hide from facial recognition these days, and I'm not terribly concerned with the facial recognition capabilities that are on our phones. What's a little bit more concerning is the facial recognition that is available on security systems that are out in the public, and how that data is being cataloged and used. You know, that's something that I would be more concerned with than the facial recognition on my cell phone, unless there is software installed on your cell phone that is capable of sharing that data. I would make sure I were looking at the settings for each of the apps that you've got installed on your device. Make sure it's not sharing any of that camera data.
Robin in Fort Atkinson, we'll go to you now. Hi, Robin.
Hi there. Just kind of following up on that Windows 10 comment from earlier that it's expiring in October.
Yeah.
And does that mean that I have to get a new laptop with Windows 11?
Well, it really depends on your laptop. So it's not expiring. What's happening is Windows 10 is what they're called, it's becoming end of life, which means it's no longer supported by Microsoft, which means that Microsoft will no longer be distributing updates for that OS. So no more security updates, no more feature updates. You'll still be able to use it if it's already installed on your laptop, but eventually it will become incompatible with newer software that's out there. It'll probably stop working as efficiently as you want it to. If you have a newer laptop and it's capable of running Windows 11, you can upgrade that current laptop that you have to a newer version of Windows 11. I believe you can upgrade from Windows 10 to 11 for free, as long as you have a genuine version of Windows 10. So if your machine isn't terribly old, you should be able to upgrade it in place.
How can you tell, or where does Robin have to go to find that out?
Microsoft has a compatibility list, so you should be able to go to Microsoft's website, and if you search for, you know, Windows 10 to 11 upgrade, it'll give you a list of devices that are compatible and not compatible with that operating system.
All right. Robin, there you go. Thank you for calling. Let's go to Marlene in Nakusa next. Hi, Marlene.
Good morning. I just was listening to you talk about your people with international phone calls and getting SIM cards. Last March, I was in Guatemala, and then the end of the month, I was in Barcelona, Spain, and I got international calls on my phone. I did nothing to a SIM card or check with my phone company. They just came through, and I'm wondering why then.
What service do you have, by the way, Marlene?
Verizon.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the calls will come into your phone, but you may not be able to make calls out, or you may not be able to use data service. I'm not sure it differs carrier to carrier, but the calls will still come into your phone, even if you're not connected to the international data network.
Yeah, I remember going to my Verizon shop and just saying, hey, I'm on my way to Scotland. What do I need to do? And they said, nothing. It's going to work just fine. And it did. So,
yeah, it really depends carrier to carrier and country to country, too.
Yeah. Thanks, Marlene. Appreciate the call. Mike would like to know the difference between an operating system and a browser, and do some work better together than others?
Yeah, so an operating system is the basic software that your computer uses to run itself. So Windows is an operating system, Apple iOS is an operating system, Android has an operating system for devices. This is like the base software that tells the hardware of your computer what to do and how to communicate with other parts of pieces of hardware within the computer. And then a browser is a piece of software that sits on top of the OS. So it's like an application that you would install locally on your computer or your device that allows you to access internet sites. So where the lines get a little bit blurred is when you're talking about a Chrome device, where really the browser, if you're on a Chromebook or something like that, the browser and the operating system are commingled in the Chrome OS. So they're kind of the same thing.
Are there ways for computers to be affected by viruses or malware other than through the internet?
Yeah, absolutely. Through external devices like a thumb drive or an external hard drive. I think those are typical ways that an unconnected computer would, you know, get infected with some sort of malware. Anything that you can plug into that computer that can execute code could potentially transmit a virus to it.
Here's another interesting email. What should we keep in mind when we're online? What are some of the basics never do or do with caution or almost always safe?
Yeah, I think when you're just using your computer at home in a standard fashion, checking email, going on the internet, most of the like known sites that you're going to, you're not going to transmit viruses through. But it does pay to have some sort of antivirus, anti-malware protection installed on your machine that you're using, on your device, that's always scanning. Essentially what it's doing is anything that tries to run on your computer, it's watching. If it's a known executable piece of code that's running, then it's ignored by that system. If it's unknown, it's then scrutinized by that system and determine whether or not it's safe. If it is safe, then that program runs. If it's not safe, then you get an alert telling you that you shouldn't be running this. So any kind of an overall security platform for your device or machine, something like a Norton 360 or McAfee, those are going to protect your devices from any code that you don't want running on your machine, whether it's from the internet or email or an external device being plugged into it. All of those different bases are going to be covered.
And do you need that coverage if you have Apple equipment?
Yes, you do. You still need it with Apple. You're much less likely to get a virus on an Apple device because there's just a much higher percentage of Windows PCs out there, and most malware is written for, PCs, laptops, desktops, those types of devices. But, you know, with the increase in mobile technology and a large part of the market share going to Apple now on iPhones, being very common, that there is a lot more malicious code out there written for the Apple operating system. So I would suggest protecting both.
And John wants to know, what is surveillance advertising? Just how much could ad tech companies know about people by tracking their behavior online?
Well, they can know a whole lot about you. They can track location data. They can track any of the health metrics that your phone is keeping on you. So if you have the health services turned on your iPhone, for instance, and it's keeping track of your number of steps or how much you sleep at night or things like that, that can be tracked. Your financial data can be pulled from accounts on your phone. Your transaction data, any internet websites that you're visiting, any searches that you're doing, anyone else that you're communicating with. All of that data, you know, in the wrong hands could potentially be harmful.
Why does, here's another interesting one, why does my laptop lag when I'm using Zoom, but not when I'm using Google Meet?
Huh. Sounds like Zoom is using more resources on your system than it should. I mean, the first thing I would say is reboot, because it's possible that if your machine's been running for a while and Zoom has a whole bunch of processes running in the background, that something might be hanging up or, you know, using too much of your processor or too much memory at once. So shutting down, rebooting, starting it back up will clear all those processes out and let you, you know, start from kind of a clean slate. Or it may be that you need to upgrade Zoom to the latest version. If you have an older version, it might be using more resources on your machine. It's possible also that there might be some incompatibility with your hardware. If Zoom is having trouble using the drivers for your camera or your microphone, that could be a problem. So I would check any error messages in log files for Zoom to see if that's an issue.
Yeah. Speaking of issues, Vicki wants to take a little issue with relating to the need for printers. She emails to say we should not assume that most people have smartphones. Vicki has a flip phone and a computer and prints a lot of things, so printers aren't obsolete. Besides, the nearest library for her is 10 miles away and is not very handy or realistic to go there for printing.
No, I agree. It's not for everyone, certainly. And there, you know, I still have a printer sitting a foot and a half away from me right now on my desk. So, you know, I have a printer at home. I'm not suggesting that everybody go out and throw away their printers. What I am suggesting is that you might not need to replace your printer if it stops working and you suddenly panic that you're no longer going to be able to print documents. There are other resources to get your documents printed if you don't want to go out and spend the money on a new printer, or more likely you don't want to spend money on the ink. That's really the expensive part.
Yeah, that's the expensive part. John in Fitchburg emailed to say that when they use the DuckDuckGo browser, frequently their cursor disappears. Is there a setting that controls this?
I have not heard of that one. The cursor disappears. I wonder if, I mean, again, I'm going to say try a reboot. you know, it may be that there's, you know, something buggy with the application that'll clear out on a reboot. If it's not happening with other applications, it may be that you'd want to uninstall and reinstall the browser if it isn't working properly. But if the cursor's just disappearing on that, that's a strange one.
And Lisa emailed to say that people could still use Windows 10 safely and effectively for quite a while, probably years, after official support ends. The trick is to keep the security software up to date, and then you don't have the need for another operating system.
Yeah, that's definitely the case. I mean, you can continue to use it as you have been. The problem may be later down the road as applications you might want to install on that device are no longer compatible with the Windows 10 OS, but you'll still be able to use it. I know some folks that are still using, you know, Windows 7 on old machines, so it sticks around. It just might not work with newer things. Just one note on the last question about the cursor disappearing. I just did a quick search, and it sounds like it has to do with hardware acceleration. So there's a setting within DuckDuckGo where you can turn off hardware acceleration. That sounds like it fixes that issue.
Oh, okay. And I don't know what this is either, but it, what is war driving in reference to Wi-Fi, and how can you prevent it? I haven't heard
that
term one before.
In years. Wow. Yeah. That's an old term. So that is, it goes back to when people first started getting internet access in their homes, and folks didn't want to pay for internet access. So they would, drive around with an antenna device that would allow them to pick up somebody else's internet signal, and they would park outside the house and steal somebody's internet connection. also a way to get on someone else's home network and steal data if that's what you're looking to do. So it really refers to folks driving around looking for open internet signals and then hijacking people's internet access. And they used to call it war driving back in the day. It's just something I haven't heard of for a while.
Yeah, that's one I probably heard about it, but have long since forgotten it, for sure.
Yeah, I would just make sure you have a password. A strong password on your home Wi-Fi network is a good way to prevent that from happening. It used to be a lot easier to hack those passwords because they were using a much weaker encryption technology. But these days, it's really hard to hack those passwords.
So these days, Beth, what are you getting from students for questions or problems or concerns? What are the big ones?
I think that, something that we're focusing on is a lot of students are coming in now with less in the computer skills and more in the mobile technology skills. They're not used to using, standard computer apps as often as we would normally think people do. Because they've been working on mobile devices for so long, and Chromebooks. So literacy, when it comes to using just a desktop PC, is a little bit more of a big deal than we thought it would be. Teaching people how to use, Word, Excel, PowerPoint, those office applications that aren't necessarily as widely used with all the other options that are out there now, but are kind of essential for folks going into the professional world.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's probably one you weren't thinking would be a problem.
Yeah, it's funny. I think, a lot of folks in the younger generation have gotten so used to using their mobile devices that they've forgotten some of the more formal ways of communicating. So, typing an email and using grammar and punctuation and all that is a little bit foreign to them.
Well, on that happy note, Beth, thank you so much for being with us today. We covered a lot of ground and always appreciate your time. Thanks, Beth.
Thank you so much, Larry. Have a great day.
You as well. Beth D'Angelo, Senior IT Specialist of UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. Well, do you have a fitness tracker on you? I've got one. Sometimes it works okay, I think, and sometimes maybe not. I'm going to find out more, and I hope you will too as we talk fitness trackers next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. There are dozens of models of fitness trackers that monitor your heart rate, your sleep patterns, they record your workouts. But are the data they collect accurate, and are they effective tools for becoming more active and health conscious? Larry Mueller here, and we're talking about fitness trackers now for the next half hour with Lisa Cadmus Bertram, who is director of the Wisconsin Physical Activity Epidemiology Lab and an associate professor of kinesiology at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. So as we talk with Lisa, I hope you'll join in. Do you use a fitness tracker? Has it changed your exercise routine, which features of your device do you find the most valuable? Can you figure them all out? that's another good question, because I've had mine for quite a while, and I don't think I've figured half of it out yet. So as we talk with her a long time, I hope you'll join in. Lisa's been studying fitness trackers. How long, by the way? And welcome.
Just thank you. I'm pleased to be here. Just about 15 years. I think I bought my first fitness tracker, the first generation Fitbit, near the end of 2010. And have you been using them ever since, and did my first research study using fitness trackers sometime, I think, starting around 2011. So it's been some time, and it's been fun to watch this group of technologies change and evolve over the years.
Yeah, and it's certainly evolved for sure. And as you listen to Lisa, I hope you'll join in. The number to call with your own question. Yeah, use a fitness tracker? Has it changed your routine? Which features do you find the most valuable? Give a call. The number's 800 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. You're director of the Wisconsin Physical Activity Epidemiology Lab. What does the lab do?
So my research program focuses on understanding the associations between physical activity and risk of chronic diseases. I mostly focus on cancer as well as management of chronic diseases. So we do a lot of work in development of programs to help people who have been treated for cancer to adopt and maintain a healthier and more active lifestyle.
And these fitness trackers can help with that.
They do, and that's part of the research program that I used to do a little bit more actively than I do now is studies in the laboratory to actually determine the accuracy of various features on different fitness tracker models. So to understand how good are they at accurately measuring steps, how good are they at actually measuring minutes of physical activity, how good are they at measuring your heart rate when you're resting, how good are they at measuring your heart rate during exercise, how well can they correctly classify what type of activity you're doing. So for example, some trackers when you exercise will notice what type of activity it is and it will record it as such. It will know that you're running, it will know that you're walking, it will know that you're swimming. So we've done studies as well to assess how accurate trackers are at correctly tagging those activities without input from the user.
So my Apple Watch, when I'm golfing, if I take a particularly violent swing, it'll say, "Oh, did you fall down? Should we? should I call? Should I call for emergency services?" And I quickly have to get in there and say, "No, it's probably just a bad swing."
That's very funny, and that's a good example that I'll use sometime in class when I'm teaching about where these things fall short. Right. So, for example, especially in the older days when they were first coming out, they were not very good at picking up steps when your hands were stationary. So for example, they would dramatically undercount my steps when I was pushing a grocery cart or pushing a stroller. And at the time, a lot of my physical activity was done while pushing a stroller. So the companies are always hard at work trying to improve their pattern recognition algorithms to be able to better understand the difference between, for example, jogging and being on an elliptical machine or, you know, cycling is another one that's difficult for trackers because the tracker is on your wrist, which is not the part of your body that's primarily involved in the motion of cycling. So there's some inherent challenges when you're trying to measure the activity of a human body, which has all these different parts, which could be moving in different directions and at different speeds and in different patterns. Yet you only have one sensor in one place. It's just the watch. It's just the one sensor measuring the movement of that one part of the body, and trying to combine that with information from heart rate and other things to make the best possible guess about what type of activity you're doing.
Well, hearing too. I go to a Badger basketball game and it's a tight game and everybody's shouting. I'll get a notice that, "Hey, it's too loud. You have exceeded what you should be listening to, Larry," essentially, because it's too loud.
Yeah, it's funny. One of the first examples when heart rate first came, the first trackers didn't have heart rate sensors. And I think around 2014, 2015, they did. And there was a year in there that the Badgers were in the NCAA playoffs and doing very well. And I'm not a basketball fan. I don't follow basketball. I was just watching this one game because everyone else was. And I got so wrapped up in it that I actually took a look down at my Fitbit and noticed that my heart rate was like a full 15 or 20 beats above its normal resting heart rate. So it is funny how they can pick up on random little things in our everyday lives like that.
Yeah. Lori in Lodi has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Lori.
Hi. Thank you. I am on oxygen, so I'm, concerned about my O2 levels. And I bought an iPhone. I already had an iPad, thinking I would get the Apple Watch and get my oxygen checked. Literally, the week I was going to go get it is when they had to stop selling them, because they're using someone else's technology, I believe. Mm-hmm. Is there another device that would be compatible with my Apple devices that senses O2? I know it's not a replacement for my pulse oximeter thing, but just for casual checking on it.
Sure.
That's a great question. And I'm not sure off the top of my head, that's not one of the features that we interact with the most frequently. You might look at the Aura Ring to see if they do. But yeah, I can imagine, like you said, it's not going to replace your pulse oximeter, but it is nice just to have, you know, another source of data coming in. So it's too bad that you weren't able to get the Apple Watch before they stopped shipping those out.
Yeah. And that's going to be, that is obviously not resolved.
Right.
So it's going to be, it could be a long time or never, I suppose.
I don't know. I hope, I imagine they'll find some resolution or settlement, perhaps.
How active does a person need to be before buying one of these devices?
I would say zero activity. One of the things that the devices are wonderful for is helping us to get a baseline understanding of what our activity patterns look like. So regardless of what your goals are, if your goals are just to go from being completely sedentary to moving a little bit, to establishing a beginning exercise routine, to something more rigorous than that, it's always important to know where you're starting from. And so I think that's one of the most valuable aspects of fitness trackers for anybody, is just to understand, what is my resting heart rate? How many steps do I take on a typical day? So that you can start to set some baby steps and some goals around that.
So there are a bunch of trackers out there. I mean, and I'm sure some are better than others. What should we look for in a fitness tracker?
So one of the things that, you know, companies need to do is they need to continually add bells and whistles and more features so that they can convince consumers that the newer model is superior to the older model. And there have been some features that have been added along the way that really have been game changers. And I would say heart rate is one of the biggest of those. But the reality is that most fitness trackers are going to have the key features that are the most important for most people. I would recommend that some of the brands that have been around for a longer period of time and have been better studied by researchers would include things like, you know, any of the Fitbit models, Garmin. Garmin is originally known for making watches for triathletes and other endurance athletes, but they also have a product line that's intended for, you know, just everyday people trying to, you know, understand their health and movement as well. Or the Apple Watch would be another good one. All of those really do have decent accuracy on the core metrics that I think are the most important, and those are heart rate, especially resting heart rate, minutes of physical activity intensity, and steps.
Lisa, excuse me, Lisa Cadmus Bertram, our guest today. She's director of the Wisconsin Physical Activity Epidemiology Lab and is an associate professor of kinesiology at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Great to have her with us today. Questions for her as we talk fitness trackers. I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here with my guest today, Lisa Cadmus Bertram. We're talking with her. She knows a whole lot about these fitness trackers. She's been working on it for many years now and personally uses them, by the way. And I hope you'll join in with your questions. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to talk@WPR.org. Are there better devices, before we go to the phones, are there better devices for, say, a runner or a swimmer or weightlifter, you know, depending on where you are?
Yeah, that's a great question. So for runners who are, I would say, more serious runners, especially if you're running longer distances, 10K, half marathon, marathon, Garmin makes some really nice devices. Often they're accompanied by a chest strap, which is really the most accurate way to measure heart rate during exercise. One of the things that folks who exercise with a fitness tracker might notice is that if you glance at your fitness tracker while you're exercising, sometimes your heart rate looks suspiciously high and other times it looks suspiciously low. And sometimes it looks about what it should look like when you're exercising. And that's one of the things that we've identified in studies that we've conducted in our lab is that during rest, these fitness trackers are very accurate at measuring your heart rate. And as you exercise, and especially as the exercise becomes more vigorous, there starts to be a little bit more noise in the data so that when you look at it at a specific moment in time, it might be erring quite high or quite low, although the average over the exercise session lands about right where it should be. So I think it's still a useful metric. But if you're in the middle of a race and you just want to get a quick metric on where your exertion is, something like a Garmin Forerunner that comes with a chest strap that has an electrode that actually sits right over your heart is far better because it will give you an accurate, you know, second by second, minute by minute measure of your heart rate variability. Weightlifting and yoga, those are really challenging ones because the movements are often not repetitive and regular enough for the tracker to be able to identify what it is that you're doing. It probably understands that you're exercising because your heart rate is up. But in general, I would say that there's a lot of great apps out there that you can use to program in what your weightlifting routine is and to log it. And that's probably a better way to track it than any kind of single sensor that you could put on your body.
Yeah, that makes sense. Pam in Wausau, I think we lost Pam. She was interested in a fitness tracker that has good security and isn't too complex.
Oh, so that's a good question. So most of the Fitbits are very easy to use, although they do have a lot of features and they keep adding more. And so I think that's a little bit of a downside. The security aspect is one that... And I was listening to part of your previous interview as well that changes over time. So, for example, Fitbit used to be its own company. It's now a subsidiary of Google. And so its terms are presumably now subsumed by Google's terms of use. So that's something to consider if you're concerned about having location data, for example. You may want to choose a tracker that doesn't include a GPS. Although, as we mentioned before, if you're carrying a cell phone around with you, your location is available through that anyway.
Richard in Madison will go to you. Hi, Richard.
Hi. So I was wondering about Android phones. And, for example, that when that lady was speaking earlier about the Apple and the feature that's missing, does that apply to Android also? How reliable are they? So on and so forth. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Are you asking about like step tracking and health features available directly in the Android phones?
Exactly.
Yeah. So the step tracking feature in phones generally is pretty accurate and pretty reliable. It really depends on what your behavior is around your phone. So, for example, if you are a person who wears pants with pockets and you keep your phone in your pocket, then it might be quite a good way to track your steps throughout the day. I know for me and for some other women, sometimes our pants don't have pockets, so we might be wearing skirts and dresses. We might have our phones in a backpack. Our phones might be in a purse. Our phones might be in a desk. And so you have to kind of think about the degree to which you're willing to make sure that you keep your phone on your body all day long. And if you do, then the phone can be a great way to track steps, whether it's Apple or Android.
Yeah, I keep leaving mine in my office when I go to the bathroom or go down to see somebody, and then now I've lost those steps.
Yeah.
It always irks me when I do that. Richard, thank you very much. Bill in Cottage Grove, we'll go to you. Hi, Bill.
Yes, good morning. I had a question that may have already been answered when I just tuned in, and it had to do with exercising, primarily doing weightlifting, which would include some cardio, but mostly weightlifting. And apparently that doesn't translate very well from the watch.
So I appreciate getting a second crack at this question, Bill, and so I'd like to expand and add a little bit more detail that might be interesting or helpful to you. First, one thing that I'll add that is not related to fitness trackers, but many people may not be aware, is that our federal physical activity guidelines relate not just to aerobic physical activity, but also to weight training. So we are learning more and more about just how critically important it is for us to engage in regular strength training throughout the lifespan. And the recommendation is that adults, including older adults, should be doing strength training at least twice a week. And there's lots of resources, lots of ways that you can do this. You don't need to belong to a gym. You can do it at home with resistance bands or just with body weight. So I just want to put a little plug in there that resistance training is not just for the jocks. It's for all of us at all stages of life, critically important to our health and our ability to maintain our independence and our function. Okay, so going back to the topic of fitness trackers, some of them do have the option where you can put in what activity you're about to do. So you can tell it, I'm about to do weight training. And then when you're done, you can say, I'm done weight training. And that way it will log that correctly and it will know what you were doing. But on the whole, like I said before, fitness trackers are not really the optimal way to track your progress with a weight training program.
All right. There you go, Bill. Thank you very much for calling. Doug in Madison, what's on your mind?
Hi. Yes, I was wanting to ask about the Vital Fit Track, which is highly recommended for seniors. It's been out, and they certainly advertise that it's the hottest thing. It has the heart rate monitoring, waterproof, sleep monitoring, step counter, calorie monitor, alarm remote, and so forth. It's the state-of-the-art fitness tracking watch. Does she have an opinion on that?
So the Vital Fit, is that the name of it, Doug?
Yes.
Vital Fit.
Okay, so it sounds like this has a lot of the similar features that other trackers have. I'm not familiar with research on this particular one, which doesn't mean that it hasn't been conducted. But it sounds encouraging to me in the sense that all of the things that I would recommend paying attention to, your steps, your sleep, your exercise minutes, heart rate, are being included.
Doug, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Call or email to ask, what are the best devices for tracking sleep? They've been using a Fitbit for years, and they need to replace it now. What about an Apple Watch or Aura Ring?
Yeah, that's a great question. So one of the things that's challenging about assessing the accuracy of these commercial devices is that, particularly with sleep. So, for example, if we're interested in assessing the accuracy of a device for steps, we can put somebody on a treadmill and count the number of steps that they're taking and compare it to the count that the tracker recorded. With sleep, it's a lot more difficult because you would need to actually have some gold standard measure of sleep, like have somebody in a sleep lab to record, to determine how accurate the sleep data are. Based on my understanding of what we know in the literature, I think either the Oura Ring or the Apple Watch or the Fitbit is a solid choice for measuring sleep. I use the Fitbit myself for measuring sleep, and I do find it somewhat helpful. I think one of the other things that people might be wondering about is a lot of the devices now have a new metric called readiness or something similar to that, which combines the heart rate data, your resting heart rate. Your resting heart rate, your heart rate variability, and your sleep to try to give you sort of a picture of how rested and recovered your body is and how ready it is for the day or for workouts. So that's another thing to consider if that's the type of metric that you're interested in.
Trista emailed, is there a specific tracker that can tell the difference between a rough bouncing ride in a garbage truck and actual steps taken? Krista can drive an hour without getting out, and it'll tell them they log between 1,000 and 8,000 steps. Also, are they somewhat accurate for measuring blood pressure?
Those are two good questions. So the driving question has been a longstanding one, and the algorithms have gotten much better for normal driving, right? And so I think that the crux of her question is bouncing around in a truck. Yeah. And I would guess that there are not devices, you know, I think all devices are, that's going to be a struggle. That's going to be a struggle for all devices. I'm not familiar with which devices measure blood pressure. Many of them do measure, you know, heart rate and heart rate variability. Yeah, I don't know how to answer the question about the blood pressure.
So heart rate, I mean, so you know, what does the watch tell you if it says your resting heart rate is whatever? I don't know what it would be, but what do you do with that?
So
with those data.
Yeah, so one thing that I notice, I'll just give a little anecdote about my resting heart rate, is I go through phases where I'm exercising quite a bit and quite regularly, and then life happens. You know, I have a job, I have three children, and things happen. And sometimes, you know, there are a few weeks at a time where I'm not exercising, and I can actually see the difference in my resting heart rate. So my resting heart rate when I've been exercising regularly is probably 3 or 4 beats lower per minute, which is a sign of cardiorespiratory fitness, than when I've really fallen, you know, off the exercise wagon and haven't been exercising for a while. So everybody's resting heart rate is different. Typically, they're around, you know, 60, 70, 80 beats per minute. But you can really learn a lot by paying attention to your own resting heart rate and whether it's increasing or decreasing as the months and years go by.
Joanne in Viroqua has something for us. Hi, Joanne.
Hi, good morning. One of your early callers was wondering about a device that does pulse oximetry or measures the oxygen in the blood. I actually have a Garmin Fenix 6, and it does have that capability. You can turn it on or off. It does use a fair amount of the battery to use that feature with it.
Oh.
Thank you. That's great to know.
Very good to know. Joanne, thank you so much. Aura rings, how well do they work compared to the watch, let's say?
Yeah, so the Aura rings are actually okay. And they do a lot of the same things that the watches do. They measure heart rate with the same technology that the watches do. One of the things that you might consider if you're interested in the Aura ring, for those that aren't familiar, it looks like sort of a thick, chunky wedding band. It's literally a ring that you wear on your finger. It doesn't have any type of display on it. So depending on how you use your hands throughout the day, you know, you might find that to be a convenient place to wear a tracker or not. It also depends on how you like to see the data from your tracker. If you use the app exclusively and you don't really look at the data on your tracker, you might not mind the ring. For me, I do like to actually look at the data on the tracker itself. So I think that I would kind of miss having something that I can look at without having to then separately open the phone.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. And boy, did this half hour fly by.
Yeah.
You'll have to have me back and do this again, Lisa. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. And thanks to all the callers for their really wonderful, insightful questions.
They were great questions. Lisa Cadmus Bertram is the director of Wisconsin Physical Activity Epidemiology Lab and associate professor of kinesiology at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Great to have her with us. And, of course, thanks to our team, Lee Rayburn, of course, our technical director today, Jeff Robbins is as well. Our producers, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnaud. And, of course, our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.